I should preface this by saying that I'm just at the beginning of a research project for an exhibition about Picasso and the Cold War for the Tate Gallery in Liverpool. And it's not planned for the exhibition to take place until the very end of 2009, beginning of 2010. And I was interested to use this structure to make more contacts with historians who might be looking at some of these issues here in Eastern Europe. I should say that my interest in this area came as a result of moving to Norwich 27 years ago, and I started the work on Picasso quite soon after that. When I first went to Norwich, I started to have nightmares, and nightmares about nuclear war. And I felt myself going back to Nottingham, where I'd come from. And I had radiation sores down my face, and this was such a kind of vivid dream that I wanted to do something about pacifism, about peace movements, about anti-nuclear, which I still feel very strongly dominates our existence. So with working with contemporary art, I'd put most of those things aside and had two children. And it's only now as I reach 60 that I'm able to get back to this central theme. In September 1985, I was invited to East Berlin and Dresden by two English women artists who'd been members of a radical political organization of artists in London in the 1930s called the AIA, which was the Artist International Association. And I did around this time a history of this movement, which people are welcome to have a look at. From 1933 to 1953. So avoiding all the normal historical divisions created by the Second World War and trying to look at a tradition of artists consistently from that point in 33 to 53, covering the Spanish Civil War, the rise of Nazism in Germany, the emigres coming to Britain, the actual war, and then the development of the Cold War in after 1945, foundation of NATO, foundation of the Warsaw Pact, and its impact on ordinary contemporary artists over that period of time. And I had a consistent archive of monthly newsletters circulated by that one group of leftist-leaning artists in Britain over that 20-year period. In 1982, I'd published a study of the AIA for the Museum of Modern Art in Oxford, and it incidentally opened the day that women encircled the US Air Force base and the cruise missiles just outside of Oxford at Greenham Common. The two women artists that I went to visit behind the Iron Curtain in East Germany had both married German emigres in London during World War II. They were members of the Free German League of Culture. In 1945, they went back to Germany with their husbands on some of the first transports into the devastation. Their husbands were Marxists, and they went back to the Russian sector. Elizabeth Shaw with René Gratz to East Berlin, where they moved in the circles around Hartfield and Brecht and other emigres. Priscilla Thornycroft, who became better known as the artist Anne Siebert, husband was appointed the professor of Marxism at Dresden University. My visit to East Germany was therefore to privileged circles and to committed, but to some extent skeptical, Marxists and internationalists. I found it intellectually stimulating interviewing a number of those artists who'd spent World War II in London. I already knew the other half of the story in Norwich, where the University of East Anglia was built in the 1960s and had many professors who were from Jewish emigre backgrounds. I remember Elizabeth Shaw saying, if anything brings down the DDR, it will be episodes of Dallas and Dynasty. Everyone watches on TV beamed over from West Berlin. They think everyone lives like that in the West. One evening, she called me into the kitchen to watch a news report of race riots in Brixton. I thought this was propaganda, as the race riots in Britain had happened several years earlier in Liverpool and Notting Hill. How wrong I was, and how right she was. The last time I met her in London in 1993, she'd lost her flat, reclaimed by families of owners from before 1945. Renny Gratt's work had been given away as she also lost his studio. She laughed about always being on the wrong side. He was chased out of Germany in 33, out of Prague in 39, interned when he arrived in England in the Isle of Man as an enemy alien and sent to Canada. He returned to Berlin as a cosmopolitan, committed artist, unable to accept the doctrines of socialist realism. So he never became a member of the DDR Academy, never received official commissions. Then finally, losing his life's work, his widow homeless in her 80s, in the final ignominy, I received a letter from their son, who had been a professor of Russian and had therefore lost his job. I received a letter from him asking me to protest that one official commission that Renny Gratz had for the Sachsenhausen concentration camp in 1949 was going to be pulled down as an example of socialist realism. But it was not the visit of 3 weeks to East Germany that affected me so much as the return to West Germany. I went to Cologne, where I had many friends, and visited the Ludwig collection. And there was Jasper John's map of the USA, Keenholtz's portable American War Memorial, and with the real Coke machine and Kate Smith singing I Love America, Tom Wesselman's Great American Nude, Lichtenstein's comic book pictures, and Warhol's Elvis. In East Berlin, I had looked, but only found two paintings in the Contemporary Museum by Soviet artists. On the streets in West Berlin, women looked so vulgar in their makeup, their fashions, and fake jewelry. And I found the traffic and noise, having been away from it for 3 weeks, was frightening. I remembered a story the Belgian artist and poet Marcel Broodhuis had told me one evening near the end of his life in 1975 at his home in Kentish Town. Imagine Europe, Marcel was telling me in his fractured English, in 1945 as a field of tulips. A fence is built down the middle of the field. The Russians come into their half of the field with their tractors and they mow down all their tulips very cruelly, just like that. The Americans come into their half of the field and they give a great big party with lots of drinking and dancing. And the next morning, their tulips are also all trampled into the ground. Now, come another season, we sit and wonder on which side of the fence the tulip bulbs are best preserved to grow straight and true again. We are now in Marcel's new season, yet I feel as though we've rushed past each other in opposite directions. We have yet to construct a framework that will enable us to understand each other. My expectations of how East Europeans might feel are not how those Western curators who've had more money to travel and make projects than I have shown me East Europeans are feeling. I've been told East Europeans hate the Russians but love the Americans. The media in the US and UK maintain a fear of Russia. We no longer see a difference between the US and the UK, although we still see a difference between the UK and Europe. I've been wondering how I can make an exhibition that will enable others to look for themselves at the political distortions in post-war history of art, both East and West. The history of art of the Cold War. This should not be to do with a crude geography of East and West or North and South, but to look at a spectrum of positions from the USSR with all its internal divisions to the Warsaw Pact countries, Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Yugoslavia, and East Germany, and then West Germany and the NATO countries, the division between Britain and France, Spain, Italy, and finally the relationship of Western Europe to the USA. So that whole spectrum of different positions. The most important artist in this period, whose reputation is in fact based on his quixotic relationship to these issues, is Picasso. He's known in the US as a symbol of the freedom of the artist in the West. In the years when Guernica hung as the most famous painting in the world at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. In the USSR, he was a symbol of peace, and he was awarded the Lenin Peace Prize in 1963. But as we all know, things aren't quite as simple as those two facts. Picasso made a series of history paintings between 1937 and 1951, but the fame of Guernica has distorted his intentions for the paintings to be seen as a continuing series of history paintings. The later paintings, this is the first one, the Charnel House of 1944, which is to do with Picasso's commitment to communism coming out of the experience of Spain, and is the massacre of a group of Spanish. I'm not doing well, am I? They tell me I just have to press that. So I do this. I'm sorry. Do I press the bar, or? Okay, that's fine. That was in 1944. This is Massacre Korea from 1950. I'm sorry, what did you press in the end? Go on to the next one. Is it just the bar? Can you show me which?
This.
This one. Okay. No, it's fine. Massacre in Korea and War and Peace from 1951. The later paintings, the Charnel House, Massacre in Korea and War and Peace, have been criticized by Greenberg, Rosenberg, Berger, and more recent critics as the aesthetic nadir of Picasso's career and reputation. Guernica arrived in New York on May Day 1939. After touring the USA, it was installed in the Museum of Modern Art in New York in 1943. At exactly that moment, the US joined Britain and the USSR in World War II. This was the period of the four freedoms of the Atlantic Charter. Picasso represented for US artists the freedom of the artist. Many US artists had taken part in the Works Progress Administration, the WPA, projects in the 1930s, and they were influenced by Marxist ideas. Picasso was trapped in occupied Paris, and with the liberation, Picasso announced he had joined the French Communist Party in 1944. And he remained a member, contributing to the French Communist Party funds for the rest of his life. And this is the copy of Humanité with the announcement of Picasso's joining the Communist Party. In 1949, Matisse gave Picasso a white fan-tailed pigeon. Picasso's newborn daughter was named Paloma, meaning dove. Louis Aragon saw drawings Picasso had made of the bird, and he recognized the value of the images as the dove of peace. Picasso's dove became the emblem of the peace movement in the late 1940s, and Picasso drew a poster for each of the peace congresses in Warsaw, Paris, Stockholm, Sheffield, Wroclaw, and Rome. The peace movement was condemned in the West as a communist front. Picasso's work was criticized in the Warsaw Pact countries and the USSR for his failure to respect the Communist Party line on socialist realism. He refused to let his membership of the French Communist Party influence the form of his work. criticism of Picasso was linked to the Soviet composers controversy and the official criticism of Shostakovich, which marked the start of the Cold War in intellectual and cultural circles around about 1948. That's Picasso. The Wroclaw Peace Congress. In June the 25th, 1950, the Korean War broke out, and Picasso painted Massacre in Korea based on Goya's 4th of May. It's the image of robotic, ironclad soldiers aiming at naked women and children. Picasso intended the painting to be a design for a mural in Paris. The previous slide I showed that it's a relatively small painting, and this is really just the maquette for a bigger mural. The failure of the project to paint a large mural led Picasso to commission himself to paint two murals, War and Peace, in a small deconsecrated chapel in the communist-run pottery village of Valois. War shows the god of war releasing giant bacteria. You see that on this side of the screen. And that was a reference to accusations that the US was using germ warfare in Korea. Coverage of US atrocities in Korea in the British media led to the sacking of James Cameron by the BBC and of Tom Hopkinson from the Houlton Press, publishers of Picture Post. In 1950, Picasso arrived at Victoria Station in London for the Sheffield Peace Congress. He was detained for 12 hours by MI5. Paul Robeson and Pablo Neruda were amongst 280 delegates denied entry to Britain. The first US airman to be based in Britain since the end of World War II are celebrated on the back page of the same issue of the Yorkshire Post, which led in the front page with the cancellation of the Congress and Picasso's brief appearance in Sheffield. Picasso never came back to England, not even for the exhibition of his work, the Tate Gallery, organized for the Tate Gallery by Roland Penrose in 1960. Picasso applied for a visa to travel to the USA in 1950, as one of the 12 partisans for peace, chosen to present the 2 million signature of the Stockholm Peace Appeal against atomic weapons to the US Congress. His visa request was refused because of his membership of the Communist Party. He never again tried to visit the USA. He always sold his work to French art dealers. They then sold his pictures onto American galleries and collectors. And Picasso was able to maintain his millionaire lifestyle in the south of France and his French Communist Party integrity. Images of him of the period portray a clown and a womanizer. In a set of photographs from the late 1950s by Robert Otero, Picasso receives Edward Steichen, Douglas Cooper, and Joseph Hirshhorn. Picasso, Hirshhorn gets out his checkbook and asks Picasso to name his price for a painting. Picasso refuses, but gestures to try on Hirshhorn's jacket and his bow tie. And gestures to Hirshhorn, now in his shirt sleeves, that they have a deal. Picasso will keep the jacket and the bow tie, and Hirshhorn can have the Picasso painting he wants. Picasso's not showing off. That's Steichen and Hirshhorn. It's not showing off. The subtext is that Hirshhorn's wealth came from the contract for uranium mining for the US government. Picasso did some commissions. That's a very familiar gesture, not yours. Picasso did some commissions for the French Communist Party at the request of Aragon, and he drew ahead of Stalin on Stalin's death in March 1953 for the Lettres Françaises. Picasso remained a controversial figure in the USSR. Ehrenberg wrote an essay for Unità, the Italian communist newspaper, in 1953 on the eve of a retrospective Picasso exhibition in Rome in an attempt to defend the artist's political position. He explained Picasso's importance was because of his subject matter. His formal language was his private concern as an artist. Ehrenberg went on to organize an exhibition of Picasso's work in Moscow in 1956. I think they've got the titles the wrong way around. It's Ehrenberg in the center and Eluard on the right. I'm sorry about that. In November 1956, Picasso signed a letter to the Central Committee of the French Communist Party, expressing profound anxiety about the suppression of the Hungarian workers' revolt by Russian tanks and denouncing the veil of silence. The letter from the French Communist Party over these issues. The letter was also published in Le Monde. A reproduction of Picasso's massacre in Korea was shown on the main streets in Warsaw. But Picasso's decision to remain in the French Communist Party was divisive in the Warsaw Pact countries and amongst communists in the West, and it led to mass resignations. The Hungarian uprising led to mass resignations in the Communist Party in the UK. Picasso's decision to remain in the French Communist Party was divisive in the Warsaw Pact countries and amongst communists in the West. Picasso's role in the post-war peace movement was applauded in the USSR, and he was awarded the Lenin Peace Prize. Ehrenberg traveled to Paris to present it to Picasso, and this is the photograph of that in 1961, which is at the height of the Cuba Missile Crisis. Picasso returned to the theme of history painting with a series of pictures of the rape of the Sabines after Rubens, painted in 1961-62 during the Cuba Missile Crisis. His point of reference to classical themes of war were the paintings of Rubens. Guernica, I don't know if you know, is a transposition reversed of Rubens' War and Peace. And this image is the Picasso right at the bottom, his image of Yuri Gagarin as a symbol of peace from that time. Picasso's post-war history paintings have been condemned by critics in the West, from Greenberg and Rosenberg to John Berger, Tim Hilton, Charles Harrison. As yet, we know little about the arguments around Picasso's reputation in the Eastern Bloc. New research is due to be published, and I hope to include this in the exhibition we are planning at Tate Liverpool. The exhibition will be preceded in autumn 2007 by a conference, and contributors will include the Greenberg scholar John O'Brien from Vancouver, Piotr Bernatowski from Poznan University, who's just completed a PhD on the reception of Picasso in the Warsaw Pact countries. And I'm also in contact with Wojciech Lahoda from Prague University, who's been working on critical appraisals of Picasso in the Czech Republic. Also, we're working with Anne Baldassare, the curator of the Picasso Museum in Paris, who hopes to involve Jacqueline François Gilliot and Picasso's old CP friend, Pierre Dax. So I'm here wondering if anyone knows of any work going on Ehrenberg and the whereabouts of archives relating to post-war peace movements in Eastern Europe. I feel there's a few theoretical questions that I'd like to finish with. The impact of Cold War politics on critical assessments of the art and role of Picasso of this period. in the spectrum of countries represented by the USSR, Warsaw Pact, NATO, Western Europe, and the US, and a reassessment of them in the light of the possibility of increasing contacts between East and West since 1989. I think that it's 20 years virtually after the fall of the Berlin Wall, new research is possible on political sensitivities in East and West with more of a historical perspective. And I think it's very necessary that we begin to kind of establish and achieve this. And I'm also particularly interested in the profound influence of German, Jewish, and East European emigres in the West after 1933, and how those intellectual patterns, which exist as much in a kind of outer European corner like Norwich, because of the history of the 20th century, as they exist here in the heartlands of Europe, in a city like Budapest, and how those intellectual patterns are at the core of intellectual debate throughout Europe because of the big diaspora caused by the Second World War. So that's really, and I've also published conference papers on that idea of British art and immigration, and the extent to which someone like Frederick Antal had such a profound impact in Britain. So that's my paper. Thank you. I finished.